Okay, our final speaker for the day is Doug Pomeroy. Doug Pomeroy has been engaged in professional audio restoration work for more than 20 years. He was for seven years a staff engineer in the Columbia Recording Studios, where he received a Grammy nomination for his work on the Lester Young Story reissues. He was the chief engineer for the Museum of Broadcasting and set up its original transfer studio. And from his Brooklyn studio, Pomeroy Audio, over the past 15 years, he's engineered more than 1,000 LP and CD reissues. I'm sorry, 100. Guess I'm getting tired.
It just felt like 1,000. So now you realize that Seth Winter is not the only restoration engineer who lives in Brooklyn and has a cedar system. I've been doing this work as you just told since 1976. Although I am a recording engineer too, so I don't spend all my time doing this. Although it's what I spend most of my time doing. What Seth and Dennis talked about yesterday, I found very, very interesting because it was rather technical. I think that what I'm going to talk about is very much related, and I think it will complement what they were talking about. As it says here somewhere, I'm going to talk about editing the wave manually. Of course, you say, well, what's manual? This is digital recording. And we're talking about hard disk editing, as it's called, putting everything into the computer and then manipulating, editing the wave once it's on your screen. What was also said yesterday, and is very true, I think, thank you, well, I sound like this all the time. it's asthma is what it is. Anyway, the advent of digital recording and editing has allowed us to do some things, as was said yesterday, that we could never do before. Just off the top of my head, I thought, well, what do I mean by that? Being able to do, for instance, an infinitely variable crossfade is a neat thing to be able to do. To be able to go in and edit a wave with a high degree of accuracy, or to go in and change the volume of something, or to filter 1/1000th of a second of a wave is something that really couldn't be done in analog terms. Or at least not very easily. We can also deal with some kinds of distortion in ways that we never could before, and we can do this one channel at a time. And what I think is most sensational of all is that with what I call manual waveform reconstruction, we can make these changes and they will be absolutely transparent in terms of the audio. And this is something which, unfortunately, cannot be said of any of the automated sound devices, any of the noise removal processors. They all have, unfortunately, some artifacts, even at their highest threshold settings. And they will all admit this if you ask them point blank. Yes, there are artifacts, perhaps very subtle. I'm saying these things are very subtle, but they are there. And it would be nice to avoid them if possible. So there, this transparency is the thing that appealed to me when I bought this editing system. The fact that I could take that click out of there and do it knowing that I had not created any artifact whatsoever was very appealing. Of course, if you have a record with 10,000 clicks in it, needless to say, you will run out and buy a Cedar system, as I did, because it just takes too long to get rid of them the other way. But this is, as I say, complements the use of an automated processor and is an adjunct, you might say. I like to, this first wave that you're looking at just happened to be something that I was in the computer the other day, and I removed this, not manually, but with the Cedar system. Cedar real-time scratch removal software. And I blew this up longitudinally, so the click is, well, that's where it was, but I've stretched this out in order to show something sort of interesting. I don't know how interesting it'll be to you, but this area right here is where the click was. It was between there and there, those two points. And that's actually probably a millisecond or less of audio time. And the curve that is there is what was put in there by the Cedar processor. And I think Sonic Solutions would do very much the same sort of thing. What is interesting is that this line that has been drawn here lacks some information that is in the rest of the program. These little squiggly lines here represent high-frequency information. It's probably surface noise, although it might be overtones, high frequency overtones in the music. So this, I thought, well, isn't that interesting? This is something I already knew. The Cedar, as like all the other processors, cause a certain very subtle dulling of the sound, a kind of, some people say, well, it takes the life out of the music. I think that all it is doing is having some slight smoothing effect on the high frequencies, and there's a picture of it. This is not serious, and you can't, I mean, it's something going by in a thousandth of a second. You don't hear this. I'm not saying you're going to hear this, but I'm saying it sort of shows you what the computer does, and my own feeling, I'm kind of old-fashioned. If I can go in and do that manually, I'd rather do it manually than have the computer do it, and I might actually go in and make some little squiggles to try and imitate the surrounding waveform. And as I say, the worst thing I could do it would be to go in and make a straight line to just join the two dots, as it were, make a straight line there, which would in fact create a new click where the other one had been. But while I was on that thinking about what happens with audio that has been processed, we had a demonstration yesterday of excessive processing. And I have an even better one. There are a lot of CDs out there that sound pretty bad. And so I just thought I would, just for the fun of it, put together an example of some what I consider to be pretty awful processing. And these are on major labels that are available in most any record store. And these go by very fast. I just threw them all together in one track. And I'm not playing the whole track. But you'll hear it on voice. You'll hear it on piano. You'll hear it particularly on brass instruments. You'll hear it on two trumpets. And listen to what happens to the trombones. I'm sure Seth knows what I'm talking about. I think it may be because the trombone has an exceptionally asymmetrical waveform. And it can... time constant in the cedar, but all the noise processors seem to have trouble with trombones, all of them. Yeah. So anyway, let me see if I can play this. Anyway, enough said. I hope you could all hear what you were supposed to hear. Digital audio workstations are now available. There must be at least a dozen on the market for both Macs and PCs. This is a picture of a window. This darkened area shows what we would call a selected region where you might want to do something in that area. You tell the computer where you want to go, and you highlight that area, and the computer will do whatever you want in that area. The interesting thing is this little icon up here, which is called the pencil. And I mean, I hope I'm not insulting anybody's intelligence. You probably know all about this. But by clicking, if you have your mouse and you click on that pencil, the mouse becomes a pencil. And at a certain degree of a certain level of blowing up the waveform, you can go in with this pencil and draw the wave and create clicks where there weren't any if you want. Now, there are several basic things you can do. Anybody who's done word processing will be familiar with cut and paste. Well, you can cut and paste audio just as though it was text. You can also do some other things. As I say, you can draw. You can isolate a region like this and do all kinds of things with it. Turn it upside down, make it louder, make it softer, play it backwards, EQ it, filter it. So those, I've just given you everything I have to say today, pretty much. those are the techniques that are available with audio. The first one I want to go into is drawing, because it's the one that I do most. The nice thing about it is that it doesn't shorten the program. I mean, you're not cutting clicks out. You're going in and you're drawing what the waveform looked like before the click damaged the wave. And of course, you're estimating, you're guessing what the wave was, just as the automated processors are using mathematical algorithms to estimate and interpolate what that waveform probably was before the click obliterated it for the length of time. I have a picture here of, this is just kind of rather typical surface noise. As you can see, I've blown that up many, many hundreds of thousands of times. Because we're talking here, maybe that total is perhaps 2 milliseconds, 2/1000ths of a second. So, kind of fuzzy. Anyway, you can see the noise. I mean, it isn't too hard to see where the noise is. And of course, you also can hear this, and you can zero in on where the noise is, and you can see that this is noise up here, and that in this area of the right channel, there are distortions on the waveform, which are not on the left channel. And there are various ways to deal with that. Right, yes, thank you. I should have said that. This is a mono recording, the output of a stereo cartridge playing a mono recording. Of course, if I had made this mono, which I could have done, you would still see noise on the resulting waveform. It wouldn't look exactly like this. It would be some sort of average of these two, and you would still perhaps want to go in and fix it. But in my own work, I always prefer to deal with both outputs of the stereo cartridge independently before making the mono mix. And I'll get into that later. Actually, my talk here is in two parts. The second part is that very subject. But this is what the result looked like with using the pencil. This is in a fairly easy example to see, it's something that anyone can do. Of course, there are some tricks to it, and there are things that you learn not to do. But that particular noise, let me see if I have a, no, I don't. I don't have a, I can't play that for you. I wasn't able to bring examples of all of these noises because some of these slides were used in a talk that I gave to the Engineering Society a couple years ago. So I don't have the audio any longer. this is typical noise. There are, in terms of impulsive noises, I generally put them into several categories. I talk about ticks or clicks as being the very short ones, milliseconds, somewhere in that range. And then as they get longer in terms of duration, I refer to them as pops and ultimately as thumps. The thumps are the hardest because they go on so long. And they're very hard to see, too. In other words, if you can, anything you can see, you can probably do something to improve it. A thump, because it has a tail on it, is a low frequency, and it has a tail that eventually merges into the music and becomes invisible. And not being able to see it makes it very hard to deal with it. And the computers have exactly the same problem. They can't find it either. I mean, to say, I'll play an example later of a thump. It's very, very hard to get rid of, and believe me, it's something that Cedar has been working on for a long time, and it's not perfect. You can't, precisely because of that time problem, the duration problem, I should say. Another thing, of course, is severe groove damage. If you had a horrendously badly grooved damage in one side of the disc groove, and cracked records, I have an example in a moment, and also peak distortion. clipping is very easy to see because I didn't bring a picture, of course, but the top of the wave is just simply literally squared off. And you can see both analog clipping and digital clipping. Of the two, digital sounds a lot worse. The squaring of the wave actually creates a click with a digital clip, and it's very disturbing. But as I say, clipping is very easy to see, and it can be removed. Again, if you want to spend the time, you can go in, and I wish I'd brought a picture, but anyway, you can go in and just simply, without exceeding the digital range possible, you can go in and redraw the wave, and the distortion is gone. Now, of course, a distorted note, like the one that was played yesterday, which goes on for, say, a quarter of a second, might have in it literally thousands of clipped waveforms. And each one, you know, think about going in there and drawing every single one of them. Well, I've done it just to see whether it would work. It works. It just, you know, it's no way to spend your life, but the automated processors can do something about peak distortion, and so I'm just exposing you to what is possible. I'm not saying that anybody in his right mind would want to do this, but I'm just saying these are things that are possible, and I thought you might be interested in seeing something of this. I guess I have a demo to show what scrubbing is like, because when you get this thing up on your screen and you're looking at it when it looks like this, you want to scrub to find exact, well, we saw an example of this actually yesterday, but you scrub the area in order to find exactly where that click is, because you have to go in and identify it and blow it up on the screen and see it so that you can draw it out. So I think this should be a demonstration of scrubbing, just to show you how you can move back and forth with the mouse. Hear the click? There. There. So anyway, that's how you... Oh, I knew that would happen. Okay. So that's about all I have to say on drawing for the moment. The next thing would be cutting. And of course, I believe in archival principles. I mean, all of my transfers are in stereo to digital tape and are never touched. And are saved, period. So I would not shorten the program unless it was for a commercial release and someone said to me, yes, go ahead and shorten the program. If that's the only way you can make it listenable, go ahead and do it. Because just between you and me, you are not going to hear the missing 1,000th of a second. I guarantee you, you're not going to hear it. And no musician in the world is going to hear a missing 1,000th of a second. It takes something close to 1/100th for anybody to really hear something missing. I don't like to do cutting, but sometimes it's the only way. it's last resort. Now this is a strange waveform, which I don't know how Mother Nature ever produced this. But there it is. And you can see musical waveforms are redundant. This is music, so you would expect to see something that looks like music. And you can see the problem here is this guy, this little negative going waveform is, for some reason, too short. And that creates a real thump when you go past that in real time. There are several ways to deal with this. I could have gone in there and isolated that one negative impulse and raised it maybe 6 dB, and it might very well have worked. In this case, I have a picture of cutting it out. This is the area right here. I've blown up. You can see that's the area which is too low in amplitude. But rather than raise it, you could see very easily that if I were to cut from here to here, these waves really are extremely similar, and Mother Nature would never know if we just went in there and cut that out. And sure enough, that's the resulting sound, and you'll have to take my word for it because I don't have the demo, but the click is absolutely, the thump or the click or whatever little weird noise was in there is gone. And as I say, that's a millisecond. Nothing to get too excited about if you've decided that you have to make a cut. Another one. This one is very serious hash, crackle, whatever you want to call it. And I chose in this case to cut, well, what you always want to do is to cut where the waves want to go together. If I had just simply cut this out right here, I can tell you it would not have worked. It would. So anyway, I found a spot. I had to take out more audio, but I found a spot where the waves would naturally have gone together. As you know, you can see this just visually. You can see what has to happen. And I say, yes, you can buy a very expensive processor which will attempt to do this mathematically, but it's pretty obvious to the eye what might work. And indeed, this worked. This was the after. You can see those two waveforms fit very nicely together. And I think actually that at this point, I probably used a crossfade, an extremely brief, maybe one or two samples crossfade, just to smooth that out. Although I could have gone in and done that manually. I could have drawn this entire waveform from here all the way up to here, and that would have worked too. There are a number of ways to deal with these things, and as I said before, if you do an awful lot of these, after a while, you sort of know which one is likely to work best, and that's, you know, in terms of time, you do generally do what's going to work best because it's faster. And this is, as you could imagine, this is fairly time-consuming. I think I have an example of actually this very click, which comes from, I think this was Dorothy Kirsten. I don't remember. You heard the click? That's the click? Now, I may have taken out two thousandths of a second in there, but I don't think Dorothy Kirsten would mind too much. Another thing we find, of course, especially with tape, is dropouts. Although there are dropouts on acetate discs as well, but it's a big problem with tape. It's probably the number one problem if you're restoring tape. I mean, forget about tape hiss. Tape hiss can be dealt with in many different ways, but dropouts are pretty serious. Sometimes you can see the dropout in the waveform, and you can go in and actually isolate it and just bring it up. And sometimes that will work, but generally, of course, you're also bringing up the tape hiss, and unless it's very brief, that won't work. Often the dropout it doesn't really contain the music. It's actually a hole in the program where there's audio missing. And this picture shows four dropouts in rapid succession. This is the result of removing clicks by scraping the oxide off the tape. and
I'm doing it some years ago. I remember that paper.
Not me, no, that wasn't me. My contribution to that sort of technology was that I used to paint them out with paint, which actually raised the playback head slightly off the tape as it went over the little tape, the paint that was on there. And it worked, but again, it, of course, tended to produce partial dropouts where the tape was being lifted off. I mean, you can't have your cake and eat it too. This was done by an engineer who shall remain nameless, but I personally find these partial dropouts to be more offensive than the clicks. And so when I was presented with this, and believe me, they were all over the place, I didn't attempt to fix them all, it would just take too long. But these four, right in this one trombone note, I found to be so disturbing that I took them out, and again, this goes by very fast, forgive me for making very brief samples, but if I'm queued up properly, you will hear you'll hear it first with the dropouts and then without. It's a trombone.
Got you.
No.
All right, let's got go. You.
Okay, back to the drawing board. Oh, excuse me, no. I'm ahead of myself. All right, hold that thought. As I just said, you can deal with dropouts and with lesions in the program, which who knows why they're there. Sometimes they're there because the disc has been so badly damaged that you've got a scratch leading into or out of a gouge, and the gouge, the stylus will actually can't really be made to cross that without locking grooves, and eventually, you know, you force it to go across, and then you have to edit the result back together. So here is Frank Sinatra. How you've changed, Frankie.
Got you under my skin. I've tried so not to give in. Got you under my skin. I've tried so not to give in.
So that involved cutting some of the program out, but again, we're talking fairly small pieces, and I used, I think, a crossfade at one point, very, very brief, to at the worst spot to put that together. So the next one is the trombone, I hope. So, you know, it still kind of sounds not very good, but at least those dropouts are not there. And the I could have given you a longer sample, which would have shown that you really don't miss, you know, however many milliseconds were taken out. It's not audible. I'm not making an excuse for doing this. I'm just saying that if you work for a commercial record company and you want to make a commercially acceptable product, sometimes you end up doing these things. Oh, I've lost all my slides here. Oh yeah, I wanted to just show you the, I guess I showed you that before. That's the same trombone bone note with the dropouts, so-called, removed. Well, I have another example. This next example, Eleanor Stieber, this is really inexcusable, but you will see why the company asked me to do it. This was an acetate which had an actual lesion in the program. I think this must have been a copy, a dub from another acetate. And somehow somebody hit the wrong button for a quarter of a second or half a second or however long it is, and the program just is not there. So I was told, well, just pull the pieces together and just put them together. And you will hear the program jumps very audibly, very noticeably. But I'm playing it because it's it shows what a crossfade can do. And I don't think I could have put these completely unrelated waveforms together very well without crossfading a few fractions of a second on either side of the splice. Wolfgang Amadeus is turning over in his grave. Speaking of crossfades, it just occurred to me that a lot of people forget that we've been doing crossfades for years and years and years with analog tape. That the crossfade you make when you make a tape splice, of course, is determined by the width of the tape, the angle of the cut, and the speed of the tape. when you take out a click, if this were a click here, and you cut the entire click out by taking that whole chunk, you would actually be taking, in this case, about a quarter of an inch, which is about a 60th of a second at 15 ips. Now, that's a long time. That's, you know, orders of magnitude greater than anything I've been talking about. But it's just interesting. I think a lot of people don't realize that the splicing block is a mechanical mixer. And you won't find a splicing block with a perpendicular cut. They're always slightly off in recognition of the fact that if you made a perfectly perpendicular cut, there would always be a thump, which would probably be at least as bad as what you're trying to get rid of. When I was at Columbia Records, we used to take these up the machine shop and make a nice, several long, you know, cuts across the block to get longer fades, cross fades, mechanically executed. Of course, I'm only talking about mono, full track mono now. With stereo, there would be a time problem which wouldn't be too nice. The next and final form of digital editing that we've covered drawing and cutting. Next we have pasting, and I don't do a lot of this because it takes a long time, but I just wanted to show you, since I have these transparencies, that in this instance there was a problem right here. I wish I could play this for you, but I don't have it. A pop or something right there. And in looking at the waveform, I could see that this section over here looked very much like this section over here. So I said, let me see if I can copy this and paste it over that. Even though, as you can see, they're not exactly the same length. And voila, it worked perfectly and it played perfectly and it solved the problem. This section was duplicated and pasted in here. That's, you know, I have to show you something that where I use pasting. You all have heard of the pack burn. One of the things that the pack burn does, we hope, is to select between the least noisy channel. Needless to say, this is one of the things I do manually. Perhaps it takes me longer, but I like to feel that I have the control, because in choosing the least noisy channel, I can also find perhaps a spot where there's a tremendously bad noise only in one side of the groove. And there, one of the ways to get rid of that is to simply take the other groove, which is good, and paste it in. After all, we're talking about a mono recording anyway. So you can cut, or actually in this case it would be copy, from one channel and paste into the other to cover noise. or another thing that I've tried is that if one channel is really terrible and you don't want it, you can go in and simply make it silence and raise the other channel 6 dB. When you make your mono mix, you won't hear a thing. I mean to say, it solves your problem completely. Another technique which you're probably somewhat familiar with because of analog processors that we've had in the past, for instance, the Berwyn transient noise eliminator and the SAE unit, is to take adjacent areas of the waveform and simply duplicate them. Hold on one second here. I seem to have. No, for that's it. I got completely mixed up here. Well, think I showed you that. Anyway, I can't find that transparency, forgive me. They slide and they all get mixed up. Just as you can take one channel and paste it over the other, you can find an adjacent area. Actually, I think that is the right slide. Let me see here. This had a problem with this wave. Again, I could have raised that. The problem is that it was too low. But I looked at this and saw that this adjacent, and this I measured, this is in fact 1 millisecond, could be duplicated and simply pasted over there, pasted right in front of it, so that you're hearing the same millisecond twice. Do you think you're ever going to notice that? Of course not. But that's the result. And it, with this form of digital editing, this kind of thing can be done with great accuracy. Certainly far greater sonic results, you know, far better sonic results than with any such unit that we've ever had in the past before. Another thing you can do, I've just been talking about pasting. The next two things are gain adjustments and filtering or equalization. One of the first things I ever tried when I bought my system was to see whether I could remove that click by simply going in and selecting the click and lowering it. Just lower it 25 dB. That would mean I wouldn't be shortening the program. And in fact, I wouldn't really be removing the click, but I would be attenuating it to the point where you probably wouldn't hear it. And in fact, that's what happens. So that's what I would call the gain adjustment technique. And I have a sample, I think, of a click, very fast. Just to show you that it really works. That click was not removed. It was lowered 24 dB. In addition to lowering them, as I say, the next thing I was going to talk about is filtering or equalization. If you have a burst of high frequency noise, as we often do, which we can call it static or hash or swish, it's possible to go in and isolate that area and filter just that area. And I have an example of that. Well, I call this a swish. It's a little tiny short burst of like that, which is not a click. It's longer than a click, and it's a lot of acetates have this on them. I don't know why, but it's very hard to hear. Forgive me, this goes by so fast you probably won't even hear it, but anyway, this is. Twice. So it was not removed, it was attenuated, it was filtered, a low-pass filter. I don't remember the frequency, but the nice thing about these digital audio workstations is that if one thing doesn't try, you've always got a backup copy, you just undo it and try another frequency until you've removed the swish or the whatever that burst of noise was without touching anything else. This is the way, basically, that I also try to deal with thumps. Which, as I said before, thumps are notoriously difficult to get rid of. This, by the way, is that same wave after filtering. It's there, but you don't see it and you don't hear it. Excuse me. So let me play you the thump. This is, you'll hear the thump twice, and then you'll hear it twice without the thump. The thump is still there. I mean, these thumps are very hard to get rid of. I would have to go back in and work on this more. But this, I think, is an improvement. any questions? what I wanted to say before I end this part of the presentation is you may think that all of this is just terribly high tech and terribly expensive and you couldn't possibly afford it and you couldn't possibly learn to do it. First of all, if you've got a computer and a keyboard and a screen and a mouse, you're halfway there. The software to do this is, as I say, many companies are making this available. It can cost you $250,000. It can cost you $5,000. There's a range. Furthermore, there's hardly a studio you can find in America today that does not have a digital audio workstation. And if you don't have digital audio, they will convert it for you. So I just mean this is not totally arcane. It's not something that's outside of the reach of the average person if he wants to get into it. It does take time, as I've not been pretending here that this is any kind of a substitute for an automated processor in dealing with some of these problems. There's a learning curve, yes. You learn not to do certain things, but you learn by doing them and finding out what happens and going back and saying, no, that didn't work, try something else. But I think that these techniques complement the use of automated processors. And in my own work, I don't think I could do any job without both techniques because I use them both in every job I do. Now, I don't know whether to take any questions there might be now or to just go on and give the rest of the talk that I had in mind. What does that mean?
Go on.
Go on. A mono recording is, after all, when played back with a stereo cartridge, in effect, two different versions of the same mono record. And as we all know, if you combine those properly, you can gain some improvement in the signal-to-noise ratio. And I have a lot. This is a rather big subject, but I want to go through it very quickly because it's kind of a footnote, and this is the kind of thing that engineers know about and are aware of and probably do, certainly mastering engineers, and it may not be something that most of you are interested in, but I'll go through it quickly. A very quick review of the development of the stereo cartridge. When we decided to make stereo records, many people said, well, hey, let's combine vertical recording and lateral recording. That'll give us two channels. Well, it did. However, the vertical recording and lateral recording each have their own problems and advantages and disadvantages. You wouldn't want all the rumble, for instance, to be in one channel only. So taking vertical and horizontal and tipping this system 45 degrees gave you two axes, vectors, for left and right channels. A left signal actually causes the stylus to move, if this is the surface of the disc, at 45 degrees to the disc in that fashion. And this is the right channel in the other way. Vertical, of course, goes right straight up and down, and lateral, back and forth. Now, the other advantage to this 45-45 system was that stereo had to be able to play back mono records, which are lateral. So this does it. If you look at these, I should have used a darker pen here, but you can see if you look in terms of the voltages coming out of a cartridge for these two channels, you will see that if the stylus moves laterally, if it moves this way, you get the positive output from both sides, two times plus. If you move it that way, it gets two times negative, which means that the two loudspeakers are moving in phase and forward and back in step together. The vertical, of course, gives you a negative on one side and a positive on the other, producing an out of phase situation. And I guess you can see that from there. So when we play a mono record, we we are getting a stylus that is moving in many different directions. It has an up and down component. It has a left and right component. It doesn't move backwards and forwards, or at least not very much, only when tracking severe warps. But even then, design-wise, it never moves backward and forward. But it does cover this arc in with a lot of movement. And what we want to do is to eliminate everything except for this lateral modulation in order to play back the nothing but the lateral. And most phono preamplifiers of probably 20 years ago, or at least many of them, had a mono button on it, which you would press and you'd say, oh, great, now I'm hearing mono. Well, you were. They would combine the channels. Modern amplifiers which don't have that button, you can always go to Radio Shack and buy a Y connector, and yes, that will give you mono. The point of what I am about to say is that it is wise to tune that mix of these two outputs, because if you just push your mono button, you are assuming that both outputs from both sides of your cartridge are exactly the same in terms of amplitude and frequency response, and believe me, they're not. That your preamplifier, both channels, are absolutely matched, believe me, they are not. That every record was cut with a cutter which was exactly perpendicular and its vertical tracking angle was exactly 15 degrees, or in the early days it wasn't. In the early days it was perpendicular. That all of these things are optimum, and then you hit your mono button and you are hearing the perfect mono mix of those two channels with perfect cancellation of any vertical, which is what you want. But you're not. So my point is that it is wise, if you can, to tune this mix of these two channels. And how do you tune them? Fortunately, the human hearing system can hear the difference between two things more easily than it can anything else. You can hear a difference better than you can a sum of two things, for instance. If you just listen to your mono and you have a way of controlling how much of the left and right channels are contributing to that mix, you may or may not get to the best possible optimum mix of those two channels. But if you listen to the difference, it's very easy. You need, again, I don't, if anybody really wants to get into this, you can come up later, but you need some way to hear the difference between the two channels, which requires putting the channels out of phase with each other. And sorry, this isn't darker, let me see it, but. One way to do it is in fact, the best way to do this is to use a balanced amplifier in one of the channels and to invert one of the outputs. And when you combine the two outputs, playing a mono record, left and right, in a mono amplifier, you will hear the difference between the two channels. Now, when you're hearing that difference, if you can control the amount of the amplitude, the amount of each channel that you're putting into this mono mixer, you can tune it. Before I play you the example, what is the vertical? I think I've mentioned it's rumble. It's primarily rumble, but that's not all it is. It's rumble from the cutter. Especially on acetates where the cutters were often not the world's greatest. The playback turntable rumble, there is a vertical component to surface noise. Even if you're not writing on the bottom of the groove, there is some part of that surface noise is purely perpendicular, and you might as well get rid of it because this is free. This won't cost you anything. There's worn and bent stampers have vertical noise. There are distortion products from vertical recording, which Maxfield discussed. There are playback mistracking problems laterally and vertically, some of which can be eliminated if this mix is tuned. Now, some people actually like the way mono records sound played through stereo, and that's because there is a there are phony stereo artifacts when you do this, and but those phony stereo artifacts are in fact the different signal spread across the two channels. That's what you're hearing. It's not in the original recording, it's an artifact. But people, I must tell you, a lot of people like it. They like to play their mono. Maybe that's why there's no mono buttons on the preamps anymore. People like to hear that kind of artificial space, which comes from the from those from, well, it has to be vertical, the vertical component, which shouldn't be there. Anyway, let me play you this example, which I hope I can talk over so you, to give you an idea of what this is all about. This is the record in stereo. In stereo, in phase. Now, in stereo, 180 degrees out of phase. Only those of you sitting in the room will really hear this. Now, if you can take that out of phase situation and pan it from one side to the other. It's still out of phase, but I'm able to control the volume of each of these channels, which I'm panning from one side to the other just to show you. Now that I'm able to control the volume of each of these channels, I can make this mono mix, I think, and you're now hearing the difference. When the channels are equal in amplitude, it disappears. Now, if that disappeared completely, the channels would be identical. There wouldn't be anything there. But of course, they're not, even though this is a very good record. Okay, you heard the difference. Now I'm playing you, I'm gonna play you just the difference signal. This is just the difference between the two channels. But this has been tuned very carefully for the null. And it's easier to hear a null, as I said, than it is to hear a sum. That's why you can use this technique to find this point. Now I flip both channels back in phase and we hear the record. With no EQ or no noise reduction, just straight off the disc. That happened, interestingly enough, to be a vertical recording. However, everything I've said applies to vertical as well. You just have to turn it all upside down. In other words, reverse everything I've said and you can play vertical records and cancel the lateral noise, which is what you want to do. This, finally, is just a picture of what a signal looks like when the two channels are out of phase. You can clearly see that this guy here down here, instead of going up, this guy is going down. So that these two, if they are perfectly identical, and they aren't, but they're pretty close, when you combine them, will disappear. Here's some surface noise, which when you turn that back around, some part of that surface noise will be canceled because it's up here too. Anyway, that's what your out of phase signal looks like. And this, I hope I haven't hopelessly confused you all, but this is something that I find important to do. I must tell you, I have one final example, which is a recording where it was a glass-based acetate which was cracked, and there's no EQ or anything. This is just raw transfers in stereo, but what I'm going to play, after I play you the stereo, I will play you the mono, which I tuned while listening to the click. And it's amazing how much of the click, it's still there, but how much of it is not there simply by tuning the mono.
Once Balboa, famed Balboa, found Pacific, his Pacific Ocean.
So I guess you get the picture. That really ends my presentation, but I have one more thing I'll throw at you. And this interests me, and I just want to see what a response this gets. There's a fellow in Long Island, New York, who named Peter Dilge. Does anybody here know Peter Dilge? Oh, okay. Well, anyway, I've never met the man, but I spoke to him on the phone, and he described to me something that Jerry also mentioned, how to play a cylinder this is the way I didn't clear this with him, so I'm not sure this is what he does, but I think this is what he does. He plays the cylinder with, he turns the cartridge 90 degrees. Now,
I think you have it on the wrong axis. He turns the cartridge,
turns it 45
this way.
Oh, really? Oh.
Instead of around there.
Okay, all right. Well, okay, next year I'll come back with a corrected picture. But, you know, it occurred to me this would be interesting, too, because, of course, it'll still respond to the vertical, which can be extracted. That's, you know, rewire your cartridge out of phase, and you got the vertical. And what would be lateral is impossible, because the cartridge can't move that way when you've turned it 90 degrees. So you've found a mechanical way to remove all lateral modulation from the cylinder. Maybe he should try this. I have no idea if this would work. Right.
Remember those old Pickerings where you could rotate somehow he clips it.
The stylus inside the cartridge, you could still rotate it.
Right. They had to wrap. See, the Shures have
the circle instead of a dime.
Right, because it's circular as opposed to Shures, which have the.
Yeah, no, I don't actually. I have some Pickerings, but I don't remember that.
He rotates the cartridge relative and leaves the stylus alone or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Because obviously the stylus has got to be fitting into the groove. Yeah, Gary.
Rotate that cartridge 90 degrees like that, wouldn't that also exaggerate clicks? Because now the clicks would not only move the stylus vertically, but the clicks would also bend the stylus laterally. In other words, around clicks on the cylinder, if the stylus is able to move this way, a click comes around and it moves the stylus laterally in relation.
But the lateral would be canceled when you made your mono mix properly. What it would do would be to supply a certain amount of compliance in this direction, which actually might help it to go over the hills and dales. Because this is the lateral now movement of the stylus. You follow what I'm saying? But it would be canceled anyway the cartridge can move back and forth this way because it's at 90 degrees. This is its lateral movement now, which is being which we're going to cancel when we combine. But in tracking over the hills and dales, it can actually move back and forth in the groove, going over those hills and dales, which would give it a certain compliance in that. You know what I'm saying? I just got to thinking about this and I said, "Wow, that's interesting." I have no idea what it would sound like. So are there any questions?